Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from my hometown of Longmont, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. This is part 5 of the Financial Literacy mini-series. Today, I will be covering the topic of protecting yourself from financial loss, discussing insurance, identity theft, and fraud prevention. So let's get started with insurance. There are really 4 ways that you can manage risk, if you think about it. You can avoid it, so that would be risk avoidance. You can reduce it, so risk reduction. You can retain it, so risk retention. And you can transfer it, and that would be via an insurance policy. So let's briefly talk about these 4 ways of managing risk. The first one, avoiding it. For instance, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of jumping out of a plane. I know plenty of people have done it safely, but it's something that, I don't know, it's just a little bit of risk that I don't need to take. Or if you want to be even more aggressive, things like base jumping. So that's like jumping off of very high towers or bridges and things of that nature, and then pulling that parachute at the last minute. I simply choose to avoid that. Or you could even, in a less risky way, say, I'm not going to drive when the conditions are poor. Visibility's poor, weather's poor, what have you. I'm just going to avoid it. I'm just going to stay home. So that's the easiest way to manage risk, is simply to avoid it. The second way is maybe it's a risk that you can't avoid completely, but you can reduce the risk of something bad happening. And a simple way of doing that would be to drive safely, wear your seatbelt, have an alarm system in your house. It may not prevent theft, but it potentially could reduce it if the alarm went off and thieves quickly left, or they saw the sign in your yard that said you had an alarm and they just move on to the next house, for example. So that's risk reduction. Another option to manage risk is to retain that risk. Now, why would you want to retain risk? Well, for instance, I don't know if you've ever been at a store and you've bought something as small as a toaster oven, and you're offered the opportunity to cover that loss with an extended warranty policy. And for a very small amount, we can cover the cost of having to replace that toaster oven. Of course, you might ask yourself, why would I need to do that? Is there something wrong with the toaster oven? Isn't it a good one? Isn't the quality good? Well, that's certainly a way for retailers to make additional money. Sometimes the cashiers even receive a bonus for selling that extended warranty. Typically, they're not used very often. And honestly, for an item like a toaster oven, you could probably manage to retain that risk if that toaster oven really did go bad after the warranty expired. Let's say it was a 1-year warranty. It might cost you, what, $30 or $40? I think you could probably handle it. So definitely retaining the risk on items that aren't going to set you back significantly is certainly a viable option. Now, there are some risks where you might not be able to handle the ramifications if they were to occur. And this is when you will typically want to purchase an insurance policy to transfer that risk to another entity, i.e. the insurance company. The way these policies typically work for the general population is for high severity, low frequency events. So if, for instance, that event occurred to you, it would be quite costly. A perfect example of this is homeowner's insurance. If your house were to burn down and it was a complete loss, that could be a significant cost to you if you didn't have insurance. However, because it is infrequent that this would happen to you, the cost of insuring it is quite reasonable. If you look at your homeowner's insurance, for example, relative to the value of your home, it's quite low. It may be 1% of the cost of your home, or even a fraction of 1% of the cost of your home. I think my homeowner's insurance, I want to say, is around $1,500. And that's covering a house. So the house itself is covered. The land, you're not insuring land, because the land would still be there if your house burned down. But it's the value of the dwelling is certainly a fraction of 1% of the value of my home. And it also has other things. Your homeowner's insurance will typically cover the contents of your house. It will also cover liability. So if someone were to fall on your property and sue you, that potentially would be covered by your homeowner's insurance. Now, if you think of homeowner's insurance, there is a portion of that payout that you're in essence retaining. You are bearing part of the risk, and that is the deductible on your insurance policy. Effectively, you're retaining the first, let's say if it's a $1,000 deductible, the first $1,000 of the cost of that event, and then the insurance company is picking up the remainder. So for most insurance policies, auto policies, homeowners, and others, there is an element of retention and an element of transfer. If you don't own a home, there are things such as renter's policies, and that also includes covering the contents of your property, the liability coverage. Again, if someone were to fall down your steps and sue you, that would be potentially covered under the liability portion of the renter's policy. Also, if you were to be at fault for burning down your apartment, your renter's policy might also kick in. For all insurance policies, there's multiple parts to it. There's the premium you pay, so usually a monthly or annual premium, or sometimes semi-annual. And this would be the case for any kind of insurance policy. There's going to be some premium that you're paying. There's going to be a deductible. It might be $0, but there is a stated deductible. It will also outline everything that is covered under the policy. So it's very important to read that policy and understand what is included in it. And there's also exclusions. So for instance, let's say it was life insurance. You might be excluded from a life insurance payout if you took on a risky activity that wasn't covered in the policy. So it's really important to read those policies and understand what is covered and what is excluded. So let's talk about different kinds of insurance that you might have or want to get in the future. Certainly, health insurance is critical, in my opinion. My wife unfortunately passed away from cancer, and I can tell you the bills were astronomical. Had we not had health insurance, we could have faced bankruptcy. That's how significant a health event can be if you don't have insurance. So highly, highly recommend you have health insurance, whether it's through an employer, which is how most people will get their health insurance. You will likely pay a portion of the premium, and it usually is deducted automatically from your paycheck. But make sure you sign up for health insurance through your employer if it's offered. If it is not, or you're self-employed or you're unemployed, I would suggest looking to the healthcare marketplaces, so healthcare.gov on the national marketplace. In Colorado, we have our own plan. Many states will have their own plans instead of the national plan, but it's important to look at your options for health insurance and make sure you're covered. There are also dental and vision plans. I kind of view those as almost like prepaid plans because, again, this is covering a low severity, frequent event. So dental, pretty much, hopefully, everyone goes to the dentist once or twice a year. And also, if you're vision impaired and you need glasses, likely you're going to the eye doctor once a year and getting your eyes checked. So that insurance, because it's frequent, pretty much everyone's using it on an annual basis, and the severity isn't very high because usually those coverages are quite low, often dental and vision aren't that beneficial, especially if you're buying it on your own. But if your employer offers it and it's an insignificant cost, it certainly can be beneficial. There's auto insurance, and that is required in most states, at least the liability portion of auto insurance. There are two other parts to auto insurance, and that's collision and comprehensive. Comprehensive would be if somebody stole your vehicle, for example. Collision is if there was an accident with the vehicle, and that's not required, but usually recommended, especially if your vehicle is expensive or you have a loan on it. You would want comprehensive and collision coverage on that in addition to the liability coverage that is usually required in almost all states, I think. Then there's homeowners insurance, which I talked about, and renter's insurance. So a lot of people don't think about renter's insurance, especially students going to college. I highly recommend you get renter's insurance primarily for the liability coverage that it offers. It's usually pretty significant liability coverage for a very nominal cost. And it also covers the contents. You may not have a lot of valuable items in your apartment, for example, but if you were to have a fire or some other catastrophe in your apartment and all of your possessions were lost, it could be quite expensive to replace all those, especially when you're thinking about computers, a television, some furniture, or some personal items, and so forth. And those renter's policies are quite inexpensive. They may only be $100 or $200 a year. So certainly from the liability perspective, it's important, but also for that personal coverage. Many homeowners policies have, like I said, personal articles, which are often called riders. So they will cover certain types of personal property included in the policy. But if you have extra items that are over and above, like jewelry or some collectible items, or no one has fur coats anymore, but that used to be a thing, they might write what are called riders to specifically call out those items and make sure they're covered. Life insurance is another big one. A lot of people don't think about life insurance, especially young people. But if you're an individual, maybe you don't need life insurance, because who is left if you were to pass away prematurely? There may not be anything to cover, for example. However, if you're in a partnership relationship and one person were to pass away and that partnership is now a single individual who is relying on that other partner's income, for example, life insurance is super important. And also if you have children, very important to have life insurance. And it's super inexpensive for young individuals. There are two types of life insurance. There's whole life insurance or permanent life insurance. And then there's term life insurance. Term life insurance is super inexpensive. And it's for a stated term, i.e. the name term life insurance, typically sold in like a 10-year policy or a 20-year policy. It might be $1 million or $2 million, and it may only be a couple hundred dollars a year to have that policy. And I can tell you it's super valuable to have, especially if you're in a partnership relationship, absolutely if you have children and somebody were to pass away prematurely. Hopefully you never have to use that insurance, but if you did for some reason, it is super beneficial for those who are left behind. Disability insurance is something else that often is offered through employers. There's short-term disability and long-term disability. If you have an emergency fund, short-term disability you may not need, because your emergency fund is effectively your short-term disability, and that's usually for a very short period of time, usually less than 6 months. Long-term disability, that's a totally different situation. If you were to get injured at work or even outside of work and you could no longer work at the job you have or a similar job, disability insurance can pay usually in the neighborhood of 60% or 70% of your current pay for as long as that disability remains in effect. So usually it doesn't kick in until maybe 6 months, and that's when your emergency fund would be useful. And then after that, the disability insurance would kick in. So definitely something to look at. It's usually relatively inexpensive, but it's something that a lot of people think that won't happen to me, but it does happen to people, and it's something to consider for sure. There are certain exclusions in homeowners insurance, such as flood and earthquake. Flood is not covered under homeowners insurance. Think of it this way. Water that falls down from the sky is covered. Water that comes up from the ground is not covered. If you live in a flood zone, you may be required by your mortgage company to get flood insurance. But if you're in a flood zone, you should definitely be looking into flood insurance because your homeowner's policy is not going to cover it. Same with earthquakes. If you're in an earthquake zone, typically that's not going to be covered by homeowner's insurance. The reason is homeowner's insurance companies would likely go out of business if they had to cover all of the homes in a flood or earthquake zone if a catastrophe like that were to occur. And if they were required to cover it, the cost of those policies would be so expensive that people wouldn't buy them. And it would be not economical to offer policies in those zones. So there's usually national flood and national earthquake insurance that's backed by the federal government. And therefore, those insurance companies can offer policies in those areas. There are a number of other types of insurance. There's business insurance, liability, errors and omissions, malpractice for doctors, for example. There's secondary life insurance. You've seen the ads for Aflac with the duck. Usually those are secondary life insurance policies. I'm not a huge fan of because there's for very specific events as opposed to a broader policy like your health insurance or homeowner's insurance. Secondary policies are for very specific items and there's a lot of exclusions in them. All right, the next section of covering yourself from the risk of financial loss is trying to avoid identity theft. Unfortunately, it's much more common than it has been in the past. And effectively, what identity theft is, it's a crime that occurs when someone uses your name, your social security number, your credit card, or other personal information without your permission. That's effectively what identity theft is. And someone is impersonating you, or potentially even I've had credit cards compromised that there's no way anyone could have gotten that card because it's locked in a drawer and I don't use it other than for online purchases or very minimal items, let's say, or even haven't used it in years, but I keep it open. And there are computer programs out there that just do random number generators and they will try to charge on a credit card just based on random numbers, and sometimes they hit. And frequently what they will do is they will try a very small charge that a lot of people wouldn't pay attention to and think it's, well, I don't know what that is, but just pay it. That's why I like the text notifications to make sure I see all of the charges on my card. And I have had cards before that have had these very nominal charges of less than a dollar. And it was a test to see if that card was valid. It worked. And then they try a big charge. And your credit card company will cover you for that. But you need to notify them right away if something like that were to happen. Credit card companies are now very good at watching out for those. So they've gotten better at watching out for cards that have been compromised and closing them and letting you know. But you need to be certainly vigilant, not just the credit card company itself, but you personally. If, for instance, someone were able to take a loan out in your name, that can be very challenging to get it cleaned up on your credit report. It's a real hassle, and it's a real pain in the you-know-what. So you want to try to avoid it by protecting your identity as much as possible. And the way you can do that is by making sure you keep things like your social security number private and don't keep a social security card in your wallet, for example. Commit that number to memory. Be careful with your birth date. I know that's hard. It's pretty easy to find out people's birth dates, but be careful about giving that out because that's a piece of personal information that can be beneficial to someone trying to steal your identity. Other personal information like family names, names of your mother, father, children, maiden names, prior residences, employers, things like that. It's very important to protect that information because those are all pieces of information that can be used to compromise your identity. The other big one is, and I'll put a link in the show notes, is to create your own social security account at ssa.gov. The reason you want to do that is to obviously make sure your own information in that account is correct, that it is tracking your earnings correctly. But more importantly, It's so that no one else can open an account in your name by creating an account fraudulently in your name. So you want to go ahead and open your own Social Security account. It will require an ID check. Usually it's done through ID.me, and it's a little bit of an effort to set that up, but when it's set up, it can be used for other government websites, for example. The other thing you want to do is shred any documents that have account numbers and identity information. I keep a shredder in my office. I shred anything that's important. However, many things are received online these days, so that's a little easier. There's not as much paper. I also do not get statements in the mail. I choose to get them electronically to avoid any statements being pilfered out of the mail, which is now becoming more common, unfortunately. The other thing to be cautious of is when you use an ATM card or a debit card. Actually, I prefer not to use my debit card unless I'm at an ATM. I also lock my debit cards. And you can usually do that online at your bank. So I lock them all down and then I unlock them when I want to use them and then lock them back down as soon as I've used them. When you're using an ATM, you want to be very protective of your PIN, your personal identification number when you're entering it. Make sure no one can see you do it. There are also things called skimmers these days, which is something that a thief will put on top of an ATM, for example. And when you slide your card or insert your card, it's going to read it and get the information from there. And then they may be trying to either see you put your PIN in or somehow get that PIN by other means. And then they have access to your bank account. So I only like to use ATMs inside of banks, inside of secure areas, and not ones at a store or outside a building, because those are easier to be tampered with. This goes the same with gas pumps. There are also skimmers at gas pumps, and they can skim your debit card. They can skim your credit card. So if there is a way to either tap to pay with the RFID on your credit card, so tapping your card as opposed to inserting it, I prefer to do that. Also, sometimes, like I know at Sam's Club, for instance, I can use my app to pay for my gas, so I prefer to do that. Anytime I can avoid using a physical card, I like to do that. Or tap to pay with Apple Pay. It's much better than actually handing a card to somebody or even using the card if it's within your hand itself. The other thing you want to do is make sure you check all of your monthly statements, your bank accounts, your credit cards, to see if there's any activity that was not yours. If there is, immediately notify the financial institution. Typically, you're going to need to cancel that credit card if it was on a credit card, and they will frequently do that automatically and then send you a new one, which will usually show up immediately. The other thing you want to do, we mentioned on the last episode, is get your free annual credit report at annualcreditreport.com. Check them at all three bureaus. Look for any errors. Look for anything that's not in your name. I highly recommend you freeze your credit at each one of those. It's very easy to do. You can, in essence, lock down your credit with a credit freeze. Now, what that is going to require you to do, however, is if you want to go for a credit card or a loan of any type, you're going to have to unfreeze it. And you basically log into those accounts. Again, you're going to have to set up a user and password at each one of those. And you will need to unfreeze your account, but you can do it in such a way it's a temporary lift of your freeze and it'll automatically go in lockdown after whatever time you tell it. For instance, I usually, if I'm going to get a new credit card, I will unfreeze my credit at all three, or at least the one that I know the credit card is going to look at. Sometimes they will tell you which one they use. And then I will unfreeze it for a period of 24 or 48 hours, and then it'll automatically go back into lockdown. So those are ways to avoid identity theft. Now let's talk about some common frauds out there, and they're constantly changing. There was one a while ago where you might try to sell something on Craigslist and somebody would say, oh, I'd like to buy that item. I'm going to mail you a check and then have someone come and pick it up. They would mail you this check. You would receive it and you would say, well, this check is for more than what we agreed to. And they're like, oh, just send me the money back. Venmo me the difference back or whatever. And then a few days later, you'll find out that the check was bad. And even though you deposited it in your account, it may take a couple of days for that check to bounce. And then they've basically received your Venmo and you can't get it back. So that was common. So be really careful about how you sell products online. When I sell stuff online, I would prefer to get cash. And then I also try to do it in a very secure area. So I remember selling a motorcycle one time and I sold it. I believe it was actually at a police station. So a thief isn't going to do anything nefarious at a police station typically, or sometimes I will do it at a bank where we can walk in together. And usually I want a cashier's check that the bank can immediately check to see that it's valid before I hand over the title of whatever it is. And I did that with an RV one time. We went to my bank with their cashier's check. We deposited it. Actually, I think it was a wire transfer. I saw the money come in. The bank said, yes, the money's here. And then I was able to sign over the title. So both parties felt comfortable with that. There's also frequently IRS fraud. So it's not the IRS fraudulently doing anything, but people impersonating the IRS, either by phone or by email. The IRS, their first point of contact is going to be the postal service. You're going to get something in the mail. They're not going to call you. They're not going to email you. They're also not going to require you to pay back taxes with something like gift cards. That's a common scam. And unfortunately, it's more prevalent than you would think. And a lot of people do fall for it. And my wife used to work at the police department. And frequently people would come in and say, I just can't pay the IRS anymore. I know you're going to arrest me. And I'm here to just say I can no longer pay. And I'm facing the consequences. And she's like, I'm sorry to tell you, but that was a fraud because that does not happen. There's also phone fraud, and this is an area ripe for fraud today because of AI, artificial intelligence, because people can impersonate other people's voices very easily, even their video very easily. And so a lot of times it'll happen to elderly people where it will be like, Grandma, it's me, I need some money. And it sounds like the person, it may even look like the person. And then that grandparent needs to send money. Frequently it's gift cards or Bitcoin, which should be the immediate red flag. But when it sounds like it's your grandchild in desperation, a lot of times people will fall for that, unfortunately. And they're also trying to instill a sense of urgency. Something has to be done now. And that's usually a red flag as well. So the best thing for that kind of scam is to have a family safe word, so that you can somehow work that into the conversation. And if it truly is the person that it's claiming to be, you would know based on the safe word that it was or it wasn't. There's also a lot of computer fraud out there. You might see a company posing as an antivirus company or trying to fix a problem with your computer through remote access. And then they're going to load some ransomware and demand payment to unlock your computer. Those are all different types of fraud. So you really want to be careful about giving anyone access to your computer. And then along those same lines, there's phishing. I've seen this recently come into my email account often. I have investment accounts and I have them at various institutions. And I get an email from what is purportedly my investment company saying, your account has been frozen or your account password needs to be updated. And it wants you to click a link inside the email. And these emails look absolutely legitimate. And it's not. It's a scammer trying to get your login and password and then obviously take money out of your account if they can get in. So what you want to do is always go to the source. Even if you think it's totally legitimate, I do get legitimate emails from investment accounts or bank accounts or whatever, but I will never click through those emails. I will close the email. I will open a browser. I will connect to the known URL or the known website directly and only go in that way. And it's the same if I were to get a phone call. I've gotten a legitimate phone call from a bank before saying, it looks like your credit card has been compromised and this is the fraud team, and we want to talk to you about this charge. And I say, thank you. But to be safe, I am going to hang up and call the number that I know is legitimate on the back of my card. And in all cases, when it's legitimate, they're like, thank you for doing that. We're glad you're being diligent. Yes, please do that. They're not going to argue with you. If it was a scammer, they say, oh no, this is us. We're legitimate. You can just, you know, whatever. It's not. So you want to be really diligent when you're contacting any financial institution that you're going through the legitimate channel, even if it looks like it's a legitimate email. So that's something to be super, super careful of. It's so common these days. And my fraud alert is super high. I don't trust anything these days. Unfortunately, that's the world we live in. The other thing to be super careful of is how you actually do log into the sites, even the ones that you know. You need to be very diligent about using specific individual passwords for every single login. I know that sounds like a real hassle, but what I do is I use a password manager that generates a very long, confusing password, and I save it in my password manager, and you need to be diligent about protecting that password manager. And there are numerous ones out there, but certainly consider the top ones. I'm not even going to tell you which one I use because I don't want anyone to even know which one I use, but there are very good ones out there. And I use a password manager to manage all of those passwords, and I do change them quite frequently. And it's very easy to do if you have a password manager. So you don't want to keep them in an unprotected file on your phone or computer. You want it to be very safe where you keep all of those passwords. And certainly don't use the same password for more than one login, and don't use easy passwords. All the easy ones are easy to guess, and these scammers out there can randomly try multiple passwords. And so you just need to be very diligent when it comes to passwords. If you become the victim of fraud, you can put a fraud alert on your credit reports. However, if it's already frozen, that's probably unnecessary. The fraud alert is a lesser secure step than actually freezing your credit. A fraud alert, if you didn't freeze your credit, for example, would require any financial institution to get some additional identifying information from you before they issued you or anyone pretending to be you any kind of credit. So they're required to go through some additional verification to make sure you are who you are. But I would say it's better to just freeze your credit and then unfreeze it when necessary, because then no one can actually, not even yourself, can get credit if it's frozen. And that's a better way. But putting a fraud alert, if you are a victim of fraud, is certainly one thing to consider. Certainly close any accounts that have been compromised. Most credit card companies are going to do that as a default. If a credit card has been compromised and issue you a new one with a new card number, don't be surprised if that happens to you. It's very frequent and happens to almost everyone I know at some point. And it's just the way it goes. And the credit card companies will not hold you liable for any fraudulent charges. You can also file a police report if there was some significant fraud, certainly, and be very diligent with who you do business with. There's a lot of fraudulent companies out there, and just be super careful about how you conduct your financial affairs, I guess you would say. So that concludes this episode. We covered insurance, identity theft, and fraud. And when you think about protecting yourself from financial risk, think of the big four. You can avoid it, you can reduce it, you can retain it, and you can transfer it. And just be very diligent when it comes to identity theft and fraud. Unfortunately, we live in a world where it's very commonplace, and with AI, it's probably only going to get worse. So unfortunately, we have to be super, super diligent. In the next episode, episode 6 of this mini-series, we're going to wrap things up. We're going to cover a little bit about income taxes, and then we're going to go through the index card, the top 10 things that we learned in this series in a very easy to remember index card format. I hope you have a great couple of days coming up until the next episode, and I will see you next time. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next time on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. Now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur, so please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.